Welcome to Season 10, Episode 5 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk about changing a character in the middle of an ongoing campaign. Again, welcome to Season 10, Episode 5 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this episode is Chris. Welcome, Chris.
Howdy, howdy.
Unfortunately, Paul is unable to join us this week. I hopefully he can join us next time, because I don't mind talking to someone else, but I always have enjoyed three for this podcast.
Well, that's contrast, and that's part of the fun.
Yeah. You know, as Patton said, if everyone's thinking alike, then someone isn't thinking, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's when you join the collective.
So, well, we have a kind of a interesting news item, which is one that I don't know how else to describe it. It's shocking to a degree that I thought this day would never come to pass. But
yeah,
apparently, Palladium Games has lost its Robotech license.
Yeah, like, you know how normally we say we don't have much news? We have news. Like, to understand the significance, they've had it for almost 30 years. It is the license that basically created the company. There was a time when Palladium Books was literally the only distributor of the Robotech series, to the point where they were making so much money that the Diamond Distributing actually approached them. So they would actually get in business with them because they were making so much money hand over fist. And, well, it's, yeah, we all kind of want it there. But at the same time, they're at a point where they can't actually do their Kickstarter, you know, wave two backers.
Yeah.
So they basically have lost the license here. And that's got to break your heart. And seeing as we generally do Kickstarters around here, well, I kind of want your insight in this, Jeff.
This one is... Well, honestly, when you read the explanation that Kevin Zambada gives in the Robotech RPG Tactics thing, why certain things have happened, because he doesn't go in, it's interesting, he does not go into the loss of the license, but he does go into the fact that, you know, they can't complete their Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre because, obviously, they took in, according to this, $1.4 million.
Yeah. Like,
which is huge.
It's mind-boggling.
Well, especially for games.
Yeah.
we've talked about it before. RPG games is not a big market. And, well, to be fair, Robotech Tactics is not technically an RPG.
Yeah.
It was a bunch of miniatures-related stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought in, one interesting thing is that they brought in somebody else to help them with a bunch of stuff, including selecting manufacturers and brokers in China where they would manufacture all these plastic minis. I'm assuming they were plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was... I think the thing that really caught them was, A... they had a bunch of delays, basically, is what they did. They had some 3D sculpts, but they had some problems, I guess, with their SD files, which were not compatible with the tooling process that the manufacturer is using. I'm going to say this from my personal experience in other areas, not necessarily gaming. This is always a huge problem when you're in North America, or honestly, even if you're in Europe, and you have to outsource your manufacturing to another country.
Yeah.
My personal experience was I worked at a company where they had a product that they were manufacturing, and let's just put it this way. They had like these little sensor pads that had to be certain spaces apart.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that you would send them exact millimeter measurements, and yet they'd send you these sensor strips that were anywhere but those measurements.
Yikes.
It's like, how the hell, you know, and you're going back and forth because you send them your calculations, they manufacture them, and then they send you a bunch. And so you have all these strips that you can't, these sensor strips that you couldn't use for this product that the company I was working for at the time was selling.
Yeah.
So that's a huge thing. And, you know, the fact that their SDL files weren't compatible, it's like, how do you not at least produce a few and go like, hey, there's some problems and figure it out early enough? That I don't understand. There's obviously, there's probably a hell of a lot back and forth. That's one of those ones that you almost want to be there at the manufacturing plant going like, what the hell are you doing? Let's work this out. And honestly, that's why major companies do stuff like that. It's like, they don't sit back idle. They always have to send someone there to the manufacturing plant to make sure things are working right. So honestly, I understand Palladium can't do that.
If we all could do that, we definitely do that for leading purposes.
I mean, and obviously the company that they were having do this, Ninja Division, probably couldn't do that either, but probably should have.
Yeah, tell me about it.
So, you know, it was, you know, and they had, they just goes on. They had a problem with their molds that they were wanting to make, you know. And honestly, apparently, it was they actually just had a lot of problems for the molds, and it cost them a lot of more money than they thought. And then the big kicker was the shipping.
Shipping will kill.
Yes. Well, and one of the things people don't understand, and I've run into this with a buddy of mine who was trying to ship a model to somebody he sold on eBay, is they no longer do shipping by weight, anybody.
Yeah.
They all do dimensional shipping, which if it's a certain size, they assume a certain weight, even if it doesn't weigh that. If it's heavier, they charge you more. But if it, and it's like, and I think this is going to have a major effect on packaging. Because, you know, basically, and I think manufacturing in general and everything, it's like people are going to try to make really small packages because even if it weighs nothing. Because, you know, like you think about your typical model, you know, the old school models, you know, they're, you've ever done model kits?
I've done a couple in my time.
But you've seen them, you know, the little car kits, the airplane kits, whatever.
Yeah.
Tanks, what have you. And they're a certain size. Well, oddly, if they're bigger, you know, in some cases they are bigger because of the nature of the kit, they fall outside of certain weight ranges where all of a sudden it's like just because of the size of the package that it has to go into, they assume it weighs 50 pounds and they charge you for that.
Yeah.
And it's like, that makes no sense. And so they ran into that, obviously, with this. And, you know, they couldn't, you know, and it doesn't matter. I mean, the UPS, FedEx, the Postal Service, U.S. Postal Service, I dare say probably other countries probably do this as well in their Postal Service as well.
Yeah. Well.
And a lot of it has to do with because we are shipping things on airplanes now. And their viewpoint is that, well, I'm not going to give you a deal if you're eating up my cargo space with something that's really light.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that's really where this comes down. It all has to do with you're eating up space. You're eating up volume where I could put more stuff in there if you weren't eating up that volume. I don't care how light it is. So that's kind of where the dimensional weight crap comes in. But it hurts everybody. You know, it sucks. Yeah. So I think, you know, as a side note, I think packaging eventually is going to change the way we buy. You know, when we buy stuff, it's going to come in a weird packaging. Like, why did they put it in this package like this? And it's going to be because it was going to be cheaper to ship it eventually. We were obviously not there. But so, yeah, this is kind of a real shocker with what they've done. And they have the Wave 1 products out. And they were hoping, I guess, to sell enough of them to produce the Wave 2 products, which I don't understand how their waves work because I didn't back this Kickstarter.
No, I didn't either. Getting back to your original concept here, like for the first 2 years of Kickstarter, shipping was really cheap in comparison, and then we had that huge blow up when it comes to shipping costs. Like you saw it, where basically we finally had a counter response to everything here. And it looks like they came in after the fact when it comes to their shipping here. Like, it was around 2010 and 2011, wasn't it? where they had that big ass blow up of, you know, when Kickstarter was still really new and the cost just went through the roof.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly.
Yeah. And it's just weird seeing, again, one of the major components of this show is we go over Kickstarters. This is almost a cautionary tale in a lot of ways.
Oh, it is.
And, well, to understand the significance of Robotech to Plenium Books, there was a time when they were the only distributors of the VHS tapes, to the point where Diamond approached them to get in on the deal. And between that and TMNT, which they, I don't think any company has ever been luckier in existence of getting a proper license before they hit it big.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but it's interesting. It's like without Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the RPG, they wouldn't have had the Ninjas and Super Spies supplement. You know, and obviously without the Robotech licenses, there would be no riffs.
Would be no riffs. I believe that completely. Or it'd be so dramatically different that we wouldn't even recognize it.
Well.
Which, for good or for ill.
Well, think about it. I mean, Robotech is the reason that they created MDC, Mega Damage.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, without that, what the hell, you know, you wouldn't have, you know, you wouldn't have.
There's no riffs. Point.
Yeah. You know, all that stuff just wouldn't have transpired, I don't think. So. But yeah, they got lucky and all that stuff. And it just seems weird to me now that it's no more.
Yeah.
And I feel sorry for these people that backed this Kickstarter. Because obviously the Wave 1 product shipped, but, you know, Wave 2... The only thing that they're doing is I guess they're offering Wave 2 backers a chance to get Wave 1 products. But they have to pay shipping.
Yeah, and we all know shipping is the devil in details. Like,
right. And their comment, though, was that this product, the product that they're giving you is product that, because they've lost their license, they're going to be forced to destroy otherwise.
Yeah, and so they're basically just dumping and liquidating the product.
Right, which is, you know, again, that's something that other people, that's what people do not understand. When you lose your license, all of a sudden, you can't even... As the manufacturer, you can't even have that product in your warehouse.
You can't even donate it under most situations here. Yeah. Like, they were just getting rid of the stuff just to get rid of it. So, and again, Plenium's known for the big-ass warehouse. It's one of the reasons why they hate changing their system. Like, one of the reasons for their success is they literally had a warehouse where they store product. That's why they tried to be as evergreen as possible. The problem is gaming theory changed over time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we learn things. Like... I don't think anybody here, well, maybe there is somebody who here, for example, do you really want to play Bushido from 1983 as anything other than like a one-shotter? And if you do, let us know. Because ideas and how we learn the rules of the game change over time. Like, we learn new theories. We learn what works. We learn what doesn't work. Like, I love old modules, but you can definitely see mentalities changed. Especially when you try different systems. Like, I will always respect the hell out of original D&D for what it did for the, you know, for our hobby. But playing D&D again, the earlier editions, well, let's just say it would have to be one hell of a sell. Because things change over time. And, well, I am wondering, like... Harmony Gold is the main reason why Macross never made it to North America.
Yes.
Because of the different licensing and so forth. And it's one of the reasons they got into fights with everybody from Battletech to, you know.
Well, yeah.
All across the globe.
Yeah, there's all kinds of those things.
And you kind of wonder what happened if they switched things a little differently. Would Palladium have succeeded without him? I don't know.
Well, it's hard to say if they could have stayed afloat. That's interesting. So it'll be interesting to see what happens for Palladium in the upcoming year. I mean, obviously Rifts is still popular, but
I think it's like the main success it's had recently is because it was able to finally be retooled to a new system, which anybody who's played Palladium for any length of time is absolutely shocking.
Yeah,
that they're using a different engine, and not only that, but they did a really good job. Or should I say the people that were involved in the Savage Rifts model. And I look forward to seeing if anything new happens because of this, or what happens with the company as a whole, or what we can learn from this. So
yeah.
I guess any of our audience who wants to put their two cents in, their own experiences with Robotech, their own experiences with Palladium.
Hell, I'd like to hear if any of our listeners backed this Kickstarter, and obviously are in Wave 2, and how they're feeling about the whole situation.
Yeah.
I think that would be interesting. So.
Very much so.
All right, well, let's get into the topic, because, hey, you know what? This one just came out of the blue, and, this is one I think we've all approached, but it's always good to hear other people. You know, especially as a game master, players always want to change characters.
Absolutely.
And there may be good reasons for that, and there may be bad reasons for that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, probably the worst reason is my character just sucks, and, you know... And sometimes that is the case. Sometimes I've definitely played games where people have had characters and you're just like, maybe you should roll up a new character. You know, this one's not quite working out. Maybe this one doesn't fit with the party. I'll use my own example. I was playing a Savage Worlds game on Roll20. I wasn't running it. And the character I had was a good character, but it didn't fit every other character that was in there.
Yeah.
And definitely if I had continued playing that particular game session, you know, that game's, you know, setting, or I don't know, campaign, if you will, I would have needed to roll up another character. Because, you know, okay, my character, obviously it was a... what the hell is that game? Interface Zero was the setting. So it was a cyberpunk game. And my guy, was, for lack of a better word, like some aging... you know, PI is kind of the way it is, I envision my character. He had like the hindrance of being elderly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I was older. I lost out on some movement. I think I had a pace of 5 instead of 6 and some other stuff. And it's like, okay, I did get a few bennies. I think I got some more skill points to spend at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, you know, I had a little bit of cyberware, you know, just enough for, you know, what I would think, obviously, a PI in this game, you know, setting probably would have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, everybody else was like these huge, and I didn't have heavy combat skills. I had a lot of investigative skills but everyone else was built on this really heavy combat, cyberware. And it's just like, I need a different character. My character doesn't fit the rest of the party. It's sad because, you know, the game master never told me that. And, you know, it's not like I didn't give him my character to begin with. He didn't, like, suggest, well, maybe you should roll up a new character. He just let it ride.
Yeah.
And that's bad. That's bad game mastering, in my opinion. If you know that someone's character doesn't fit with the rest of the party, you need to talk to them about it.
Yeah. This is why I emphasize episode 0 to meet with your party to figure out the ground rules before you start, because...
Well, sometimes, especially if you... like me, I was in the middle of, I started in the middle of their game.
Yes.
So I didn't have that option.
Yeah, but, and then on top of that, you should know what the lay of the land is before you start. And if the GM doesn't do that, that's kind of a dick move.
Yeah. So there's that's a legitimate reason, obviously, to maybe swap out a character.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking about character deaths here, by the way, because that's a natural reason to swap out a character.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to assume that if your character dies in a game that's basically death-based, for lack of a better term, getting a new character sheet is not, you know, it sucks, but it's not unexpected.
I mean, again, like I said, what is the bad reason? You know, obviously, just because, you know, that's usually, I just want something a little more powerful. Like, Billy over here is XYZ, and I feel that he's more powerful than my character. Okay, that may or may not be true. And if it is true, you know, maybe that's just a teaching moment as a game master. You have to go like, well, yeah, maybe, but maybe you should think about your character in a different way.
Yeah, that's true. I got my own story.
Okay, go.
Shoot. Second edition Dungeons & Dragons.
Not a big fan of second edition, but that's just me.
Yeah. Well, I was bored. I built a pacifist priest, and it took 3 episodes before I was allowed to change him.
Oh.
Yeah, that was not an experience I want to repeat. Because D&D is so designed not to play pacifist characters, it's not even funny.
That would
Yeah,
be
it was
more,
one of my first characters.
yeah, that would be more of an NPC for most games.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, it also depends on how you define pacifist.
Yeah, well, there literally is a pacifist kit back in the day
Okay.
where you weren't allowed to actually hurt anybody, but at the same time, you got relatively good healing. And then I
Well,
found out the horrible truth: you don't get any XP if you don't do anything, because I had a GM that was a bit of a hard ass.
oh, you see, now that's, see, that's a dick move. I've always been a big fan of, I think at some point I kind of stopped caring about everything, you know, like, oh, XP for killing? No. XP for gold? No. If did you play? Did you have a fun time? Here's a set amount of here, everyone gets a set amount of XP. If you did some spectacular role playing or you did something spectacular, I'd give you some more. Because that you know, and I mean that was a whole lost art. You know, people just go like, well, you know, even today it's like, well, these are the here are the combat ratings that we got. So let me do the XP. What the? I mean, even today that really boggles my mind. It's like if you've gamed enough, then you should just say, here's some XP. You know, I decide the flow of how often or how fast you actually advance.
Yeah,
And
exactly.
I know that sounds weird, but you know, I think that's why I always went to that mindset was because it's like it's you know, maybe I want you to play five or six adventures before you hit third. I don't know. You know, especially now. I mean, it's not like back in the day, you know, AD&D, you wanted to be third, fourth, fifth level. That was the sweet spot because you could actually start doing stuff,
Yeah,
you
well,
know.
dude. First level, if especially in the early version of D&D, and some would argue even fifth, first level characters are fragile as hell. So you almost need them on a Rolodex, at least until you get to like second or third level, where you start feeling like you're actually a little stable. Like you're still gonna have to fight within your weight class, but
Right.
you know, you're not gonna die in a tall breeze or a one kobold with a lucky shot. And I guess another one that basically when you're changing a character is both niches and lack thereof. Like for example, we're playing a cyberpunk game. I built a Netrunner. It's not working out because I'm basically playing a game separately from everybody else.
Right. And that's actually one of those ones that I always recommend never the, to me, especially in Cyberpunk, all that net running computer stuff, I know it sounds horrid, but that all those should always be NPCs.
Yeah. Well, again, characters design, which has definitely changed over the last few quite a few years. It should be party based, not PC based, if that makes any difference. Because then everybody feels like they're doing something. Like, nothing sucks more than being a duelist on a spaceship if you're not in a dueling campaign, because what are you doing? And that's another thing, like, if you're building a character. Or if you need a character, let's say you need a cleric in your party for a D&D.
Oh yeah. I mean,
And, you
you
know. Sorry, go on.
no, that I mean you're absolutely right. That's the thing. It's like as horrid as it is, almost every game has niches for players. Savage Worlds, even in Savage Worlds, I think that's there it is a little bit like that, but not as bad because players can kind of come up with a whole bunch of crazy stuff and you're like, "Hey, you just don't have a certain skill set." Okay, fine. We'll move on.
Exactly.
But especially in games where there's a lot of what I'm going to call archetypes, heavy archetypes.
Yes.
Even if, you know, I mean, even if there are no fixed classes, but they're like archetypes. Like, let's face it, Champions just has a bunch of archetypes. Like, oh, we have a energy projector, we have a brick, we have a speedster, you know, choose some, you know, kind of thing. And it's like, well, there's no set classes, but the genre almost forces you to be certain things.
Well, if you want your shining moment to be awesome, you should have a different power set than everybody else. Even if it's just by a little, you know?
You know, not that said, I've heard of people that run like all thieves or all magic users or all clerics, say in D&D, and I'm like, well,
All bards, I've heard it. I've seen it. It basically becomes a band.
yeah, I think I've read an article about that from somewhere. But no, you know, so obviously, you know, I mean, you know, like you said, so what's the major reasons to change a character, of course? It's like, hey, the player's no longer feeling it. The player's bored.
Yeah,
I
player's
mean,
bored. That's
yeah,
another big one.
that one by itself, I mean, if the player's bored, then yeah, it's time to do something else. And that especially happens with people who for example, have always played fighters. They've never stretched out and like, I'm bored with this. Well, maybe we can have you play a different character, you know?
Or if you build somebody who's just strictly mechanical, hey, this was fun, but now it feels repetitive.
Right. You know, we obviously, like you said in the second one, the character just sucks, and that happens. Sometimes it's just a bad character, and you don't know it initially. You know, and it could be for any number of reasons. Maybe the backstory you have, for some reason, it's not meshing with the rest of the campaign, or, you know, because it doesn't have to necessarily be, like, character stats.
Yeah, like, what if the character's a racist, and suddenly he's in a party with a race that he absolutely despises or something? Well, he probably shouldn't be playing a racist to begin with, but unless it's, like, for narrative.
Right.
But you get the idea.
You know.
Throw the character out and get somebody who's a little more tolerant so you can at least have some interplay with each other. Like, as fun as the elves and dwarves are, they both stood up against Mordor.
And then you point out, wrote self into a corner. Yeah, that happens, you know. And that especially happens when people decide that they want to run. It's like they're really interested in this background that they have. And the Game Master's keen on, okay, let's explore that background. But eventually it's just like you hit a wall.
Yeah.
And I think that
you saved the princess, you got your artifacts, you got your nobleman back, you're done.
Yeah. You know, and, well, where do you go? You know, the question is just, well, where do you go from there? So, and obviously we've covered, you know, hey, the party has a need. What is that need? And, you know, and like I said, you know, can't dismiss what do you need as a player?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
like, if you're not having fun, then something's gone horribly wrong.
Right. And, you know, sorry, I'm just...
No, go for it, man.
I don't know what I was going to say, so please continue.
Well, again, the whole point of gaming, you're not going to make a lot of money in it. You know, it's a creative outlet. You should have fun, at least some portion of fun while playing it. If you're not having fun, it becomes work. And if you're not getting paid for work, what's the point?
Exactly. So,
you know?
But... All right, so there are some reasons to create a character, you know, change your character. Now comes the hard part, actually doing it.
Yeah.
And this only becomes hard because, A, if you're in the middle of a... It's easy if you're between story arcs.
Yeah.
That's the best way to describe it. I hate actually using the word campaign anymore because it's a campaign, but... It's more, a lot of times it's just settings with various story arcs because, you know, you have a story arc, you complete it, well, you can pause, and then those characters or a portion of them can start another story arc.
Exactly.
So I don't know why I'm starting to like the word story arc instead. So, you know, obviously the story has a beginning and end. So if you're at the end of one or you're at the beginning of a new one, that's when that's a good chance to say, you know what, I'm no longer interested in playing, I don't know, my D'Artagnan type character. I want to play something else. I want to play, you know, Gandalf.
Yeah, he graduated and, you know, he's a full knight's musketeer and I want to retire the character and switch characters.
Right.
Something a little more suitable because we're going to be on a pirate ship next game.
Right. Or who knows. But so that's always a good point. But in the middle of a game, it gets a little tricky. And I think...
Yeah.
This is where you really have to, as a game master, you have to work with your player.
Absolutely.
And it does get tough because depending on what's going on, it may really limit what you can introduce. Or you have to come up with a real reason why something's there. Like, let's face it, if the party is lost in the middle of the desert, actually, that might be easy. You know, you meet someone else who's lost in the desert, but still. But, I mean, it can be tough.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Or if you're in a dungeon... And one of your party members die, but you're not ready to go back to town yet.
Right.
What, are you going to find somebody as a prisoner? Or are you going to find them, like, stuck on hallucinogenic mushrooms?
Well, and those are weird canon options. It's like, oh, they're a prisoner of some... You know, the party runs into some creatures that have captured the new player.
Yeah.
You know, which can be tough because that's something you have to work with the player on because he has to be okay with that. Because I've met those people that are like, I would never be captured. Then this is never going to work. You know, you have
to... It's called narrative effect. Come on, roll with it.
I know. But I'm just saying, that's the weird thing. It's like, a lot of players don't like to be captured.
Yeah.
Which is it's so against like every story you've ever read, you know.
Dude,
you know, it's like, it's like classic.
Look, from The Princess Bride to Doctor Who to who knows what else.
Flash Gordon. You know, and which is why I love that in that game where they have the cliffhanger token. You know, exactly. And it's like, you know, that's like one of the options, I think, for, it's like the players can be captured.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, you get captured now, and then you you get some bonus later. You know, it's a negotiation exactly. At that point, which is kind of cool. But, you know.
And adds to the narrative, and it basically has the story fail forward.
But obviously, Prisoners, you know.
Like another. Mm-hmm.
Just like you said, lost people. Someone who just got lost for some odd reason.
Absolutely.
You know.
Like, the other thing is, like, the mentor program. You got your prodigy you've been working on kind of in the background in the effect here. Like, you're training somebody, and then when your original character dies, you have them ready to go, like, kind of a plug-and-play concept.
Yeah.
Like, D&D used to be really big into this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you usually start at first level, so you might as well get the guy going while you're waiting. So that he's not such an extreme level grind when you actually get there, because you're not going to be in a first level character in a 10th level party.
Yeah. Well, and then of course there's always the whole family member option.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I mean, I know how many times I've seen people do that. Oh, let's go ahead and it's a family member. Okay, that's fine. Especially if they want to play like the same race, but not necessarily the same class.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that. One of my favorite characters died. I played a dwarf fighter back a long time ago. And I died like one level before I got a certain special ability. I think it was Fire Eyes, because I was playing a cleric, dwarven cleric. So I said, okay, screw that. I'm playing his brother.
But you know. See, you know, and again, those were opportunities for role-playing or just a little bit of storytelling.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, let's face it. Everyone plays games a little differently. Some people are very more mechanical with their things. But it doesn't mean that they can't have some of these aspects to it for just minor story tidbits, because it does make play a little more interesting, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And again, if they're a background character where you can draw from, like if you're on a pirate ship or you're at court or if it's part of your clan, then suddenly you have much more options to integrate a new character, just sort of swap them out as interchangeable parts.
Yeah.
Well, and also it allows you to do something with the other part thing when you have this PC that's now doesn't have a PC to work with. Player that doesn't, you know, character that doesn't have a player to work with.
Yeah. Well, I was also thinking the other, you know, there's other options where, you know, you're in a foreign land and now, you know, you can pick up character, you know, you for some reason, you know, that's the thing about players is like sometimes it's like if they're in a location that they're not normally from,
mm-hmm.
you now have to, your options for characters is just wherever you're at.
True.
Which may be a little bit harder, you know, for the player, you know, and that, I mean, obviously that's the conversation you have to have. And you're like, well, you're at this location. What, you know, here, you may have some of these options to maybe choose someone from obviously the local culture, but they may not have all the options that you're looking for. And you know, obviously that's a negotiation again between the player and the game master.
Mm-hmm.
But it also is interesting because, well, now you might have someone, you know, especially for characters that, my character sucks. He never really has his 5 minutes of fame, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if you choose a character from the local culture, maybe he might have insight. That character might have insight to the culture that the players desperately need, and so therefore, your character is now very important to them.
Yeah, and exactly. Like, this is when you can play that weird and wacky exotic race that you wouldn't normally be allowed because you're stuck in the bloody Underdark.
Right.
Or you're stuck in Karatur, or you're stuck in Planet X. And you finally get some options that would not normally be allowed in the game. Like, for example, if you end up in, I don't know, Land of the Dinosaurs, and you're allowed to play, like, a Soriel Man. You know, because you're the local guide of the group. But whether you keep the character after the fact, even if you do, you're unique. Because of different options that would not normally be available, but now are.
Well, hell, you know, I'm just thinking of other things. Like, even, I mean, we're talking, you know, things like even, hey, you know what? The player can actually play that orc or goblin or whatever.
Exactly.
Because, you know, yeah, and of course, why he wants to work with the party could be a whole interesting subset of the adventure. I mean, it does give the game master opportunities.
Yeah, and plus it solves the prisoner dilemma as well. You capture a bunch of orcs. You don't want to kill them. Well, guess what? One of them's now a PC. Problem solved.
And you have to come up with a... Well, I'm just saying, you still have to come up with a rationale why you would allow them to be part of your party. There could be any number of reasons. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, it is interesting, you know, to be able to do that, because it's like, hey, we can do those things. You know, we can have fun with things that we don't normally, you know, I think that's where the opportunity is sometimes, because I'm a big, I hate it when people come up with these fantastical creatures they want to play, and like, why are they with the party? This is one of the situations that if you're in a dungeon where there are these fantastical creatures, it might make sense that you finally have some of them in your party somehow.
Yeah, and, exactly. Like, and, it fits the narrative better.
Now, that said, the other players have to be willing to accept that.
Yeah.
You know, and
well, yeah.
I mean, here's a big one, you know, for this is, especially if you know someone is going to, let's say, be leaving the campaign for a long time. Maybe let's say they're going to go on a trip for a couple months, and you want them to go out with a bang, but they can't really do it with their current character. This is a good chance for them to play like a one-off character too. You know, I don't know. I always like that idea. It's like, or if someone, you know, like let's say people just come in. Let's not even changing characters. Sometimes it's like, hey, you know, someone wants to come in for a couple of games, but they're not going to be a regular person. You know, it's a good chance to have them play something special, so they get something out of it. The players get something out of it because hey, they had this interesting thing happen to them.
Yeah, no, not disagreeing there, because, again, gaming is teamwork. And if everybody is building something that's interesting or fascinating that actually appeals to their thing, but it works both ways, you have to facilitate your fellow players and the GM. Otherwise, somebody gets burnt out and nobody has fun. Yeah.
This is where games like... I read the rules, but I always wondered, what happens when you want to add players? You know, have you ever read the Diaspora rules?
I don't think I've had the pleasure. Do tell.
It's a fate-based game. And what happens is that when you, you know, they have the concept of Sessenger where the universe isn't even made yet. Everyone generates a couple of worlds and they contribute to some information about them. You know, and the two worlds that each player generates, the player that they start with comes from one of those worlds. They get to choose.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very collaborative, let's build a universe kind of thing. But I always wondered, what happens when you need to add new players? You don't generate new worlds, right? I don't know. I never read that in the rules. So if anyone knows, I'm kind of curious how that is handled in that game.
Yeah, because then you're coming into somebody else's world. And I'll be blunt, gamers can be really sticklers when it comes to their own universes, even more so than canon worlds. Like, I don't know about you, but I've gotten into a couple of arguments involving the Forgotten Realms for no real reason.
Oh, trust me. I've met a lot of people that are really big fans of Forgotten Realms. And, you know, the rules, it's like they're Forgotten Realm historians. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not that interested.
Yeah. Well, again, I like history as much as the next man when it comes to fictional environments. But there comes a point where, are you having fun? Then I don't need a history lesson about some place that doesn't even exist.
Right. Traveler was a big, you know, for me, Traveler has a very, very interesting hook on that, where people who play Traveler have this there's actually, in my Traveler universe, IMTU, it was always an abbreviation, you know, and that was it. It's like, you know, okay, there's the Traveler setting, you know, the Imperium setting for Traveler. And people just go like, in my Traveler universe. It's like, so you have different referees playing the same general setting, but their take on the setting is completely different.
You know? As long as your tables don't interact, it really doesn't matter.
Right. But it's just interesting because when people post stuff, they don't talk about, well, in the Imperium it's this way. They go like, no, in my Traveler universe, this is the way I perceive this. There's like almost, they understand that not everyone's, you know, like, for example, if they were doing Forgotten Realms, they would understand that not everyone's Forgotten Realms is identical. So
absolutely. And, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you in the slightest in this one.
But, okay, so you got a new character, right? You got your shiny character. What do you do with the old one?
Well, there's a number of things you can do with that. You can, well, the official one is if you just want to retire him and have him ride off into the sunset. Well, if that's agreed on, then you don't need to worry about him and it's out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, and sometimes that's good, you know. Another option, I always think, is, you know, you retire the character, but it's something like you close out whatever minor storyline they might have.
Yeah.
Give them a happy ending, if you will.
Oh, I got no problem with them running off into the sunset. They finally and it actually extrapolates them and allows them to even play a thing behind the scenes when the GM takes over the character.
Or,
what if it's the local noble?
There's always the option, if it fits the character, to do something where they go out in a blaze of glory.
Oh, hell yeah.
You know, I mean, that's always... I've actually done that as a player without talking to the Game Master. It's like, you know what? I'm going to do something incredibly stupid and save the rest of the party just so I can make a different character.
Absolutely. That's, you know, death by die roll, basically.
Well,
and again, if you do it right, you become a legend. And then you could be used as a myth for other story arcs.
Right. So, yeah. So you can retire the character, obviously go out in a blaze of glory. You mentioned relegated as an NPC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What if he's your mentor? What if he's the local noble now because he kind of grew out of adventuring because he had obligations? He got married. Or if he's now the local innkeeper because there always seem to be freakishly high PCs.
Yeah, this is kind of the area where it's always hard as a game master, but you always want to have like enough notes about a player's character. But it's tough. I am horrible at this. I'm not going to lie.
Okay, no problem.
But I'm just saying I'm horrible at it because it's like I have all my own stuff to care about. What, I'm going to make some notes about every single PC? I don't think so. I don't have that much time in my life. Especially now, I mean, you figure...
Well, exactly. You know, basically give them 3 to 5 unique things that you can use for story hook purposes, so even if you retire the character, you might be able to use them. And if he's a particular character that wants to go down a certain path, make him the villain of your piece. He retired because he ended up getting a cursed item, or he made a deal with the devil, or what have you.
Or maybe he was just on that path before you knew it. Maybe he was this kind of is the NPC, but it's just, okay, the villainous slant, really.
Yeah. And then he might become the main driver of the story, even though he's no longer being used by a PC, because he's gone down a dark path, and now you got to stop your buddy, you've adventured with, which adds emotional pathos.
I was just thinking, it may not necessarily be that the person is evil, either. Yeah. He may become the villain because, well, they were just really good and the rest of the party was just really bad.
I don't know,
that just came to mind. You know, or...
Well, that'd be hilarious.
I'm even thinking of, like, some of the, you know, Old West stories where, yeah, he used to run with my gang back in the day, but now he's the sheriff of the town.
Exactly.
You know, those sort of things.
Yeah, and he wants to put it behind him, and that's the whole story arc.
And it's interesting because depending on what goes on, that might be a reason for the player to come back and play a certain character again.
Yeah.
That's why when you retire a character, sometimes you have to keep the character around. And if the game master uses the character for something, eventually it might be that he has to update the stats and maybe that player plays that character again for like a one shot or a two shot.
Even just the base soul or something. Like, you go to hell and you find, he's now a devil. Because he's been actually getting up in the ranks. Because of maybe the actions that you did.
Right.
The pathos.
All right, and your last one you have here is, I like it. Use as a legend.
Yeah, this is kind of the thing here. I had to swap out the character. But I swapped him out at a crucial moment. Like, let's say he pulls a card from a deck of many things or something. Or I need to grab the artifact and I need to imprison my character for all eternity. And now I become a legend that might be used to drive other stories.
Yeah.
Or, you know, basically fall forward. You got to get rid of the character. And even if you never use him again, you now remember the story of the man who grabbed the orb of insert name here.
Yeah.
And that's part of the fun. Okay. I got one last thing I want to try, and it's another one of these silly die tail tables. I created a table a while back with that idea in mind that you needed to retrain your character and kind of replace your character, so forth. If you have a D20, I wouldn't mind you rolling on it just to see what comes up.
Let's see what do I got for. Let me.
Yeah, this was originally for a post-apocalyptic world with magic, but I think it'll be fun regardless of what comes out there.
I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to quickly log into Roll20.
Sure.
Launch one of my games and just roll the die there, because I don't, my dice are God knows where.
Yeah, that's fair, given the circumstances. I kind of sprung it on you here.
So, come on. And the answer is 5.
Dimensional journey. You fell into a pocket dimension, and, well, you really don't want to talk about it. A bizarre tint to your skin is optional.
I like it.
Yeah. Well, it kind of went into all sorts of crazy directions. You can be trained by the ancient master. You can be drafted by the military. You can end up in a fugue state, lost at sea. And, of course, I had to end with the natural 20. A wizard did it.
Because don't they always?
Well, dude, yeah. Basically, well, technically it could be any spellcaster, creature, magic. Some sort of wizard definitely did it. And as a result, your character has been radically changed, but is still playing the fundamental same character. It's a way to, like, it's just something I built for, well, honestly, I'm bored with my character. I need to rebuild him, but I want to keep him within the story arc. So, hey, look, my evil twin took over.
Who has a completely different set of abilities.
Absolutely. Like, stuff like that will keep you intrigued and keep you going, and may even help progress the story, ultimately. Just a crazy idea.
Yep. Oh, there's actually one other one that is kind of, I'm thinking more along the lines of superheroes,
mm-hmm.
but it's an option. You're playing the same character, but because of something, your abilities have changed.
Yeah. Like, the evil mad scientist ended up mutating your character, and now, instead of having adamantine in your bones, you now look like an ape creature.
Well, I'm even thinking of actually in D&D, it's like, you may have been a human thief, but for some reason you died and you got reincarnated into a lizard man, and now you're a fighter.
Exactly.
Something along those lines, you know? I mean, there are those things where you are technically playing a new character, but you have the history of the old one.
Exactly. It's kind of the closest I can get to, you can get to having your cake and eating it too.
Yeah.
You're not throwing out the story, you just went down a really weird path. Reincarnation.
Yeah. But that spell was always weird in first edition anyway.
It's fun as long as you expect your game to end like one episode later.
So. All right, yeah, anything else?
No, I think we covered it for the most part, but if anybody wants to add anything else, go for it.
Yep. Well, why don't we then get into the Kickstarters?
Will do.
And the first one up is from John 4, which is The Demon Plague, a 5th edition campaign with Sandbox and Hexcrawl. In a post-apocalyptic setting.
Wow.
So, I don't know. John 4's done a lot, so he actually has got his goal. He was only... The conversion to the U.S. dollars was only a little over $1,900, and he's at over 14,000, almost 15.
Yeah, and I recognize the other name there, James Intercasso, who, honestly, I wish I could produce as much as he does. Like, any award winner, he's done a crap ton of modules, he has multiple podcasts, he was originally on The Tome Show. You're getting good people, that's all I'm saying. You know, like, just by the names alone, it's worth it. Plus, they have multiple progressions.
Yeah.
Classic linear adventure, sandbox, hex crawl, and a mega dungeon finale. Which means you're getting a different experience every time you're playing it within the D&D aspect.
Right.
Which, honestly, you should. Because otherwise, there's only so many orc hunts you can get in before you get bored out of your skull. And if it's always changing the aspect of how you're getting there, well, that's part of the fun.
Here's the one that I think is interesting for people, is the highest level. I don't know. Do they have any backers? They have 22 backers on it, too.
Holy shinoli.
Is the Star Elf Adventure Building Course. You gain access to a 12-hour video course on how to build an adventure just like the Demon Plague with core adventures, sandbox, and hex crawl elements.
I almost want to do this just to give you feedback for one of our podcasts. I just don't know if I want to spend the money.
I don't want to spend the money, but I think that that is a wonderful thing to do.
No, I think it's a fantastic capstone for your Kickstarter.
You know, and they've had 22 backers, which, yeah. Let's see, let me do the math here, if I can, because at 150 times 22, that alone, those backers alone was their over their pledge amount that they wanted.
Yeah, and right? I think this is the new benchmark for anybody who ever runs a, you know, Kickstarter for an adventure anymore. Like, I'm going to have to look it over with more detail. I'll probably end up picking it up out of morbid curiosity because, honestly, I know the people involved, and they seem to be, they produce good product.
Yeah. So, this gets my, I'm interested, but I can't afford it.
Seals. Yeah, I know the feeling. Yeah, like right now I'm in the, hey, that's shiny, 24-hour rule.
Yeah.
Got to give it a day, decide if the still shininess comes on, because there's a good chance you'll go, wait a minute, what was I thinking?
All right, so where are we? I'm going to put that with that. So it's weird that there are two RPGs of sorts this go-around that are superhero-based.
Okay.
We first have Superlatives.
Mm-hmm.
They were only looking for roughly $337 U.S. They've actually reached their goal of $735.
Right on.
You know. And I don't know. It's fairly cheap, you know, for their setting. Because let me see. So it is about $7 for PDF copies of basically everything you need for their game. And I think it's meant to be a very simple game. The character sheet that they have showing in their video is fairly simple and straightforward. So
indeed.
I don't know. It's just one of those ones where you're like, eh. I think my problem is I've come to the point where it's like, I like the idea of superheroes playing superheroes, but I don't think it ever works out.
Well, it's...
And I don't mean that to be cruel.
Comics cheats. I won't lie to you. I'm not going to miss any words.
Right. So.
Yeah.
And then
at the same time, nice simple kiss him, relatively cheap, and they made his goal, so well done.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so then on the other hand, we have Era the Empowered, a superpowered RPG. And they were asking for about $3,000, and they have twice that. And this, let's see, $15 for the PDF rulebook.
No, it's not too bad.
No. And, I mean, they have some weird add-ons. I love this one. A $10 add-on, character built by the creator. Okay. So. But, yeah, so the way it works is $15 for the digital rulebook, $42 for the paperback, $65 for the hardback. I don't even know. Let's see. Do they have any backers? They have 12 backers for the hardcover.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but I don't know. It's one of those. I don't know if that's any better anymore, the hardcover versus the softcover. Paperback, you know. I mean, I think for a lot of games, the paperback's just fine. I mean, you're spending, what, an additional $23 just to have the hardcover? I don't know.
Yeah. I'd have to see the game before I can pass judgment one way or the other, because maybe they know something funky that I'm not familiar with.
You know, the artwork that they show for this looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they have their character sheet looks a little technical to me.
Yeah. I'm going to throw up my own little recommendation here. They may or may not have done this already. I would highly recommend for 6 months before you do a Kickstarter, try it out like on a podcast or an online game or something, just so there's actually results here. Like, in fact, I was talking to a buddy of mine. He was recommending before you try running a Kickstarter, have a YouTube channel with all the ways to explain everything like they kind of did here. But I would also recommend running like a couple of modules, like show other people playing your product, because that'll give you an idea of what you're working with.
Right.
And do it long before you even think about doing your Kickstarter.
That said, they do have a YouTube video about how the success and fumble rules that they have work. They also have a video of a 1 hour session play.
Good, good, good.
And here's the thing. Dice and Stuff ran a 5-part The Empowered podcast. And they have said you can listen to the campaign here. So they have 5 episodes of showing off the system. So there you go.
Yeah. This is basically required for any new system that you're not familiar with. Like, you might get away with Fate or D20 not having this. But if you build your own proprietary system, show us how it works.
So that's kind of cool. I mean,
you know, like, again,
I'm kind of the setting that I love superheroes, but I've come to the conclusion there. I don't know if it actually works for an RPG anymore. I think the power levels are a little high. I don't know. It's weird. I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, I think it's just because I play Champions way too much. And at a certain level, I'm just like, meh, not interested.
Well, again, I have a lot of respect for Champions and what it did. But it also felt like I was doing homework sometimes.
Well, definitely taught you math.
Oh, good Lord, yes.
So.
And ratios. Okay.
So we now have 2 monster folios, basically. The first one up is the Total Party Kill Bestiary, 5th edition monsters for veteran heroes.
Mm-hmm.
They're asking quite a bit. They're asking almost $16,000. They got almost 5. They still got 26 days to go, though.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I like this. Put simply, the Total Party Kill Bestiary is quite possibly the greatest compilation of high-level monstrous foes compatible with 5th edition. This project focuses on developing monsters of challenge rating 10, above 10, putting special emphasis on non-human and non-legendary creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
and they're organized in thematic groups, and...
Yeah, which is cool and everything, but I usually don't need that high level of creatures. I'm not saying that it couldn't be interesting, but I think at a certain point I just reach I go back to what I would like someone to come up with, even if you end up with a bunch of repetitive things, a system sort of like the like I said in the old Dragon magazine, there was this thing about random monsters where you roll on some table and you randomly generate a monster with abilities.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that again. Someone to come up with something for 5th edition, 4th edition, Pathfinder, I don't care.
You know, that reminds me of like Fantasy Craft, where they had that great table in the back where whatever level you were, you could easily just find out the gauge of the rough monster. You just put some trappings on it.
So let's see, $18 for the PDF, and then $38 for the print and the PDF.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually not a bad bump. $38 for the—that's about probably about right. Did they have a page count? They say 75 monsters, so that I don't know. Yeah. Let's see, 75. Let's say 75 monsters at $18.
Yeah, say about a page a piece, so it's probably about 75 to 100 pages, roughly.
I don't know.
That's my guess. Maybe. Plus pages for indexes, which are always important.
So, all right, and then next up is the Folio of Fiendish Monsters for 1st Edition Monster Compendium. Wow. They're asking for 10 grand. They're at almost $6,500. They still have 10 days to go.
Yeah, it's doable. I'm actually impressed how much of a market there is for 1st Edition Monster Manuals.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm kind of like, wow, this is kind of weird. It's 128 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And $25 for the PDF and $50 for the hardcover. I don't know if it's worth $50. But, okay. Let me give you a couple of examples. Probably maybe the PDF only, but I don't know. And they have some really high-level stuff here.
Okay. Somebody who's far more into the OSR movement has to be the one to evaluate this product.
Yeah, I don't
know. I find it very curious, but I don't know.
The only thing is that they have a cover by Jeff Easley.
Dang.
So that's impressive all on its own. I think some people buy it just for that.
Art sells product.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm not disagreeing. Wow. That's a name I haven't heard in a while.
Okay, and there's some really high low. Okay, there's some other Packers. But, I mean, it is interesting how many monster stuff that comes up in Kickstarters. Here's more monsters. And it's like, I actually understand maps more than I understand monsters.
Here's the one that kind of rubs me the wrong way, but kind of doesn't. You can spend $500 or more to make a two physical and PDF copies of the folio, and you get writer's credit and the ability to create a new monster that appears in the book. That's a little expensive to be a monster designer. Like, especially when you compare it to something like Creature Codex, where they ran it as a contest and they said, here's a whole bunch of options, we're going to grab the best of them.
Yeah. It's just,
you know.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that happens.
Yeah.
All right, so next up we have Found by the Way Pathfinder RPG Location Modules. And it says a series of location/adventure modules compatible with the Pathfinder RPG. So they're asking for $2,000. They're at $911. They still got 25 days to go.
Okay.
Kind of,
you know, without looking too hard here.
So I'm trying to look at, because it's like $15 for one PDF copy, $8 for one PDF copy of a Found by the Way module of your choice, and then $15 for two, and then $20 for all four. Where does he describe the four settings?
Yeah, he basically talks about all four modules here.
Okay, here we go. Campaign will support publication of four modules. Path to Dark Harrow, a farming village, unaware that a drow mage is planning to wipe it off the map. Path to Old Gnome Argosy, a shipwreck that contains more than the party bargained for. Path to Oyster Cove, a fishing village with an evil storm cult in its midst. And Path to Sylvanholm, a wood elf coping with encroaching... Oh, a wood elf village coping with encroaching humans.
I do like the fact that they're actually adding an Easter egg for their backers that's only going to be contained within the limited edition version. Kind of a way to show that you supported it. Kind of a quick inside joke.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually a pretty cool draw for the most part, because that's always been the dilemma. You want your backers to feel special, but if you ever decide to publish it beyond the backers, you want a way to make sure you can actually twist it around and give them, you know, the people who missed the Kickstarter, either due to lack of finances or just didn't hear about it until, like, long after. You know? So it's always been one of those things I've always wrestled with. How much specialized content do you give to your backers that people won't get later?
Yeah.
I don't have an answer, so I guess I'll just have to stew on it.
Yeah, so far, there are only 23 backers, so I don't know. Again, it's funny when you look at the backer counts, especially for these smaller projects, and you just realize, okay, that's a very limited audience.
Well, Pathfinder, I think it's waning a little bit, you know, as far as the market's concerned. Yeah. It's done a damn good run. God knows we'd love their numbers if you're running your own game company.
Right.
But you can definitely tell they're at the point of oversaturation in a lot of ways, so... Yep. I wish him luck, and if you want to show your product, let us know.
All right, so next up we have, there are two RPGs. One is Liminal RPG. It says Liminal is a self-contained desktop RPG game about people caught in between the modern world and the world of magic. And the way they describe it in their text, Liminal is a new tabletop about those on the boundary between the modern-day United Kingdom and the hidden world, the world of secret societies of magicians, a police division investigating 14 crimes, fae courts, werewolf gangs, and haunted places where the walls between worlds are thin.
Okay, so it's urban fantasy then.
Yeah, so basically you have kind of the Dresden Files.
Yeah, basically that's, yeah, I was going to say that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And again, part of the fun is drawing on myth and legend and figuring out how you can put a spin in the modern day aspect, because okay, confession time. I've seen Bright a few months ago, and I like it, but I don't love it, if that makes any sense. You know, it's that one with Will Smith. They basically edit orcs and elves to our world. To create, you know, kind of the idea here.
Yes. So now that I think about it, I've actually seen that on Netflix.
Yeah. Like, I can see why some people are complaining about lazy world building to some degree, because I love Alien Nation. It's one of my favorite movies. Actually, I think I prefer the TV show, but you get the idea. But a lot more makes sense when they've only been here for 5 years than millennia. Because things change. Like, if orcs have been in your world for 1,000 years and they turn against the dark world, you know, Lord around the Renaissance, that's 500 years of transformation. Look at how much our world has changed in 500 years and how much it would change differently if it wasn't recent.
Right.
Like, I would argue the most definitive example of combining fantasy with, you know, modern settings has got to be Shadowrun. But Shadowrun takes place, I don't know, was it a couple of years ago?
I don't know. I honestly, that was one of the cyberpunk fantasy games. Cyberpunkish games that I just never cared for.
Yeah. Like, I would have to see the world and see how they tie the two together. Like, it's hard to play, for all intents and purposes, the great and wonderful Wizard of Oz, where you have to keep looking behind the curtain. But then again, that's what brought World of Darkness to the dance, is the idea that everything is behind the scenes. So take it what you will.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like it's uninteresting, but it's not interesting enough for me. But they have reached their goal. They were asking roughly for a little under $5,000 when you do the conversions. Mm-hmm. And no. Right now, the conversion U.S. dollars are at almost $14,500. And they still got 23 days to go. So people are interested in this, which, you know what? If this is your thing, I say go for it.
Well, it looks fun, and I like its art. I like the picture of the, I don't know, shadow. I don't know if that's I think that's a wolf.
Yeah,
kind of in a smoky background.
Probably because they have werewolves, I guess.
Yeah.
And again,
it's not like we can jeopardize concern. We were talking about a Monster Mash last week, so we can't really judge in that regard.
No. I mean, it's, like I said, it is interesting. So.
Yeah.
All right, so next up we have Far Away Tabletop Role-playing game.
This sounds fairy tale induced.
It just says Faraway Land is a rules light fantasy science fiction weird gonzo lighthearted setting that incorporates simple mechanics, colorful artwork, and pop culture into a unique tabletop RPG with an old school feel.
I think I know what they're trying to rip off. Adventure Time.
You know what? That's what I was thinking.
Yeah,
so.
Not a bad thing. If anything, it's fun to, you know, take it and make it your own, and I won't lie to you.
So
the idea of a gonzo adventure in a wacky kind of fantasy environment wouldn't be my first dance.
Yeah.
Like, angry telepathic nuns running grizzly bears battle interdimensional Abraham Lincoln clones.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's a sentence.
Well, they reached their goal. They were only asking for $1,500, and they're at $6,500 plus, so can't complain with that. So they'll reach their goal. So again, probably not my game, but you know, this would probably be a game that I would do a one shot of, like at a convention.
Oh, absolutely! Like, you know. I think it could be. Well, again, I'm a sucker for Gonzo, and this is another one that's going to be on the 24-hour list, just to see how it goes. And I'm curious, but I don't know if I'm curious enough to put my money where my mouth is. I guess we'll find out.
All right, so we like, obviously, covering conventions.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a Kickstarter for the Sin City. I think that's how you pronounce it, Sin City Con. Board gaming convention that's happening October 12th through 14th. And that's, by the way, in Cincinnati, not Vegas, in case anyone was curious.
Because that's why it's spelled with a C.
Exactly. So they were looking for $6,000. They're at, they reached their goal, which is kind of cool. And
Yay. Basically,
I think they were just doing pre-sales for their badges, where $35 for their badge. which is kind of cool because I guess at the door it's going to be 50.
Yeah.
So if you happen to be near where they're gaming in Cincinnati, then I say go for it.
Absolutely.
You know, I've reached the point where I actually am going to tell people that skip Gen Con, really. Mm-hmm. Go to a smaller, more local convention.
Every time you go to a local convention, increase the likelihood of having it around next year to try something new and exciting.
Right. And it's just, honestly, fun that way.
And besides, this way you get connected to your local community, even if it's like a city away.
Yep. Okay. You know? Let's just get the last one out of here and let's go home. How about that?
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Last up, we have Devil's Run RPG game, which is described as there's two systems. The 2D20 and the Savage World setting, and it's a post-apocalyptic game setting. Of course, it is. It looks like it has bikes.
Yay.
It is based, I guess, worthy of a George Miller movie. High octane on Route 666. There you go.
Okay. I'm going to have that down and watch it on my own personal thing, because now I'm officially curious.
Yeah, I guess there was a board game.
Mm-hmm.
Called Devil's Run, and apparently this is the RPG based on that. And of course, it's, you know, you have the Savage Worlds version, you have the Modiphius 2D20 setting. And so they've reached their goal. They're asking a little under 10 grand US, and they're at like almost 12 grand. There's only about a week left, but the core rulebook for in PDF format, about 14 bucks. That's not too bad. I guess you just choose which version. I would imagine, unless they have...
Okay.
I don't know. It doesn't really say. Unless their rulebook contains both versions. I'm looking at their... Does it say to choose one over the other? I don't see. And of course, they might ask you when you actually...
Well, it looks fun. But at the same time, one of the dangers of post-apocalyptic games is... It ends up as Food Quest.
Food Quest. Yeah, that was Twilight 2000, by the way. Food Quest or Corn Quest.
Exactly. Because, you know, you spend a good chunk of your time looking for basic provisions, food, water, ammo. Yep. And it gets to the point where, unless it's fun for you, it's going to be kind of boring.
Yep.
You know, because... I don't know, but that's ultimately up to your personal game preferences and so forth. Like, I'll be blunt, if I'm going to run a post-apocalyptic game, it'll probably be more like Thunder of the Barbarian than Mad Max. Although there are elements
of
it I'm taking.
I'm a bigger fan of Thunder of the Barbarian.
Yeah. Because that way you can look cool. A bit weird.
Yep. All right. I think we're going to close it off with that, because I actually need to get out of here, and we need to quit making these episodes almost 2 hours long.
Yeah, not bad.
No, a little over an hour and 15, I think, is what this is going to come in at, which isn't too bad. And for those of you we bored, I apologize. But if you do have anything you want to tell us, you can send us an email at info@rpgcircus.com. You can go to our Facebook page, post something there. You can go to the RPG Circus homepage and post a comment on the episode itself. And I will be more than happy to answer all those questions or read emails, do whatever. Because I love a comment, so send us some comments.
Indeed.
Any closing comments from the peanut gallery over there?
Not much to mind, other than tell me about your rebuilt characters.
Yep, exactly. We want to hear about rebuilt characters or new characters or why you switch characters.
Exactly.
And even if it's lame, if you want to say, he was lame, I would like to know why he was lame or she was lame or whatever. Give us a little meat. So with that, we'll be more than happy to play any of those comments in 2 weeks. What do you think?
Sounds good.
All right. So we will see everyone in 2 weeks.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.